Oh, I am going to ask for a volunteer to chair our meeting tonight because our chair and vice chair can't be there. My hand raised. Thank you so much. And it's a little script. With that, I'm going to turn it over to you, interim chair.
Good evening. Today is March 4th, 2026. Our regular special meeting for the Interville Housing Committee meeting. This meeting is called to order at 6:01, is it? PM. The meeting is being audio and video recorded. Staff will take a roll call at this time.
Okay. So Chair Strauss is absent today, as well as Vice Chair Hill. Member Drummond?
Here.
Member Jessup?
Here.
Member Johnson?
Present.
Member Medeiros?
Present.
And Member Oakley?
Here.
Awesome. We do have a quorum.
All right. Now is the time for public comments. Each speaker will have 2 minutes. Anyone who wishes to make comments related to items not on the agenda should raise their hand and identify their name for the record once called on. Any of it?
And I have not received any in writing either.
Okay. Ask the secretary if there are any comments received. He said no.
Fall down.
Yeah.
Our agenda items, starting with 5.1, Housing Advisory Committee, CY.
Let's actually back up to number 4, approval of the February 4th minutes.
Agenda, okay.
Yes.
After each item's presentation, you can ask committee members, are there any clarifying questions?
Any clarifying questions on the minutes?
Don't see any. Are there any public comments on this agenda item? None.
Nope.
Now is the time for discussion. None.
To do approve the minutes.
Second.
All right. And let me go ahead and see if we can get them approved. So we have Member Drummond. Member Jessup.
Aye.
Member Johnson.
Aye.
Member Medeiros.
Aye.
Member Oakley.
Aye.
All right, and then item passes. Action item 5.1, Housing Advisory Committee, CY25, Annual Report, and CY26 Priorities.
So I don't have a presentation today. So what we are required to do on an annual basis is do an annual report to City Council talking about the things that we've done over the last calendar year, and then also talk about what our priorities. So in the packet that I provided you guys, I went through all the meetings that we had in calendar year 25 and identified the different things that we talked about. I will say that in our last annual report, our goal was to meet more frequently and consistently, because we had a lot of issues getting a quorum. We had members leave us, and so we were not able to meet. So at least for the year of fiscal year 25, we did meet 6 times, not 10. Well, we got 6. So that was an improvement from the previous fiscal year. We had a lot of things that we discussed. We, of course, did all of our annual reports. We talked about our Emeryville eviction trends. We talked about our accessibility program, our first-time homebuyer program, rental junk fees. We talked about our TOC planning grant and the work plans for those projects. We talked about the regional housing portal. We talked about the Bay Area eviction study. We talked about our new website, rental preservation. We talked about a lot of different things over the year. So over the past year. So we did do a lot of conversations about topics that were important for us. So what I have provided you guys for at least for fiscal year 26, which is the calendar year 26, which is where we are now, is an identification of what the City Council's priorities are. And then also what is in our housing element as to work that we need to accomplish over the next 2 years. And so what City Council is asking that you guys would want us to focus on over the rest of the calendar year. And so with that, I'm going to open it up to conversation to you guys to kind of talk about what are the things that you guys do want to prioritize for the rest of the calendar year.
Just for clarification, so we're choosing two to prioritize among those that are not listed as city council priorities. Is that right? Or does it include city council priorities?
What I did was identify everything. So I wanted you guys to, there's a couple things that kind of impact this committee. So one, we receive our direction from city council. There are priorities that the city council has identified in the strategic plan that are priorities for them. There are also things in our housing element work plan that we're obligated to do. So what I wanted to do is there's always way more things that we have out there that we need to work on over the course of a year. But I wanted you guys to be aware of what city council has identified as a priority. What are things we know we have in our work plan? It's up to you. You guys can pick something from the city council priority list, from our housing element list. In the past, we've had things that weren't on either. But I do want to set some expectations that these are things that at some point we do need to talk about. We do need to work on. I don't know that there's a guarantee that we'll be able to resolve all of them, but what are the things that you guys want to prioritize specifically for the next year? And it's up to you to decide if it's coming from the list or not. My preference would be that it does, but it doesn't matter what my preference is. It's your guys' decision.
I think that tenant protection is pretty important.
Okay.
And just to also clarify, so just because we don't prioritize everything here, because we can only choose two, it does not mean that these things will not be worked on.
That is correct. That is also correct.
It's really just what we want to discuss in this group, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
Tenant protections was a priority for last year as well, and I think it makes sense for it to continue to be a priority. It is something that we're hoping to bring to conclusion before the end of this year, but I think it's a great suggestion for it to continue to be a priority for the committee. A lot of committees have similar priorities year over year.
Did the city council by any chance give any reasons for why these are their priorities?
So when they did the strategic plan last year, they kind of looked at all the major projects that were out there. There were over 40 things that were through the entire city that came out as major projects. They identified their top four. None of the housing related issues are their top four, but these are major projects that the city has committed to working on, which is why they're on the list.
I can interject here because I was there. There wasn't a lot of discussion around it. What they did is they used a voting platform. So they, because this was their second, strategic planning session. So in the first strategic planning session, they had listed everything the staff put together. That was all the projects we were working on, distilled it down to four through a voting process. And then they did the same thing last month. And they just voted on their phones. And then the top four vote getters ended up being the top four priorities.
Okay. Yeah. So it's not like there was no discussion
around it. Not really, no.
Wait,
there's a little bit around things like, revenue-based measures are very important to the city's functioning. And so, there's a little
but
bit
of none of the housing things were their top four.
Right.
None These are that. Things that are on their overall list, but not in their top four.
None of them got.
And you'll see things that are on the housing element that are also not on their priority list.
Right.
So that's why I wanted to identify them both for you guys to understand.
That might be a reason for this committee to prioritize some things that are not on the city council priority list, but are on the housing element work plan. And I would put forward the assess housing needs of the artist community. It's something that we've discussed here before. It's something that we already have on the agenda coming up, I think, within the next couple of months. We've already sort of committed to discussing that. And it's something that I think hasn't really been discussed in other parts of the city government very much recently. Is something that we can really, I think, help to bring to the table and to discuss. So that would be my suggestion.
Okay. So I see a couple questions. It's a development of the Christie Avenue sites. That's someone right over there by the freeway, right?
By the public market.
Okay. And then it's this first-time home buyers program, still going on, but it's already established and
that is correct.
Yeah. I'm going to say there's not much discussion of it other than updates.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the Measure C housing bonds program, mm-hmm. like
I don't see that on there on the housing element.
So it is.
The city council identified the entire Measure C as a priority. In the housing element, the different programs within Measure C are identified. So like the first time home buyer was a Measure C housing program.
Okay.
The development of the Christie sites and 4300, those are receiving Measure C funding. Our rental preservation program or homeowner retention, those are Measure C funded programs. And yeah, so those right there, there are a couple of others, but those are the ones that are at least identified as midterm priorities in the housing element.
Okay.
And then the regulatory, affordable housing regulatory program, what is that exactly? So that is some modifications that the city will be making to our affordable housing program when it comes to the planning and regulatory side of development. So right now, our ordinance talks about if you're building a project that has 10 or more units that's rental, a certain percentage of those units have to be affordable at certain income levels. We're making changes to that to hopefully increase the number of units that'll be affordable and change the income mix that's being funded through our TOC grant that's helping us do that analysis. So that will come back to this committee, but that work is underway. So that is something that is ongoing.
I like that when work on those.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good
one too. I do want to stay in the know about the Christie site.
Mm-hmm.
That's super close to my house. Now I know what's going on with it. So I've heard three. Are there any others for consideration? And then you guys can kind of decide amongst yourselves. What are the two that you want to make your priority?
Also like assess barriers and rental marketing plans to serve underserved populations. Like what's that about exactly?
So one of the things that's within most of the federal programs is this requirement to affirmatively further fair housing. In doing that, you're supposed to assess who is least likely to apply for your housing and then develop a marketing plan to make sure you're targeting those specific groups. We don't have federal funds in our projects, but in our housing element, that was something that we wanted to work on identifying to make sure we are reaching those who are least likely to apply. So we've done our first gathering of data related to Nellie Hannon Gateway to understand of all the applicants that they got. What is the ethnic and gender breakdown of those who applied? And then of those who actually got into the unit, what is that? Mm-hmm. And are there any patterns? Are there things that we're seeing as to, well, how come all of this one group got in? Mm-hmm. Or how come we didn't see any people who were of this ethnicity apply? If we didn't see anything like that happen, then what we need to do is figure out, well, are we not reaching out to that group in a method or in a way that they're getting the information about our available affordable housing? So that kind of analysis is something that we'll be starting to work on this year. Like I said, Nellie Hannon Gateway was the first one we've been able to capture that data on. We've just started asking to collect that demographic data, but it's going to help us when we get our next project to say, okay, we saw these deficiencies in the last project. We want you to make sure that you are doing outreach to this group, to, you know, making sure you're reaching out to these type of nonprofits or organizations that might support and serve that type of that specific population.
I might be backtracking a little bit, but on the accomplishments for 2025, it says the BMR tenant certification. What was that?
It wasn't an accomplishment. Those are just things that we talked about.
Is what we're providing.
This is everything that we talked about. Okay. So what I typically do, we'll talk about all in the report, we'll talk about all the different things that we worked on or that we discussed.
Mm-hmm.
We did not have a lot of action items. Usually the action items are our accomplishments.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a lot of discussions on things that are much longer projects that aren't things that we're going to get resolved in 1 year. And so for that was just an information topic where we talked about the change in the HOTLA laws,
mm-hmm.
and how we need to update our guidelines. We're waiting for the change from the federal side.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not an accomplishment, but there's been an update and progression towards us working on that project.
Okay, and will that fold into the affordable housing regulatory program, or is that completely different?
We're related, though. Yeah. Our guidelines actually are for the units that are built under the affordable, okay. Yeah, housing
so,
program.
So making that a priority, we're all going, yeah.
Yeah. And would that also include the assess barriers and rental, or is that its own thing?
It's a separate item. I mean, they're somewhat related. They all kind of get folded in, but the housing element required us to identify each specific action. There are quite a few things that are kind of all interrelated, and they'll all like work off of each other, but they are specific actions.
I think that one is super important.
Can I ask clarifying questions about a couple of the ones on the second page there? Mm-hmm. Identify incentives for developers to provide space mm-hmm. for supportive housing services and or supportive housing units in residential housing. What is that one about exactly?
That's a good question. So the supportive housing. So what it is saying is that there is not just a need for affordable housing. There also is a need for housing set aside for specific groups that need supportive services. Mm-hmm. And so while we don't just want to create affordable housing, we want to make sure that we are developing and incorporating housing that serves all members of the community. Because we have to have supportive housing units. So we're trying to figure out, is there an incentive? Is there something that we can do different to not just continue to build affordable housing, but to make sure that we're building in housing that targets specific groups that may need assistance? Could be homeless, could be transitional age youth, could be veterans. There's a lot of different groups, but is there an incentive, regulatory or financial, that we can put in place to make sure that we are building those type of units that also need to be built within the Bay Area?
That's a good one too.
They're all good.
They're all good. What is the live work school preference policy?
So we have a live work school preference policy within our affordable home buyer. Our affordable rental housing program that says if you live, work, or have a child enrolled in Emory Unified School District, you get a preference point in the lottery when it comes to available housing. There are some nuances that we have discovered that we need to work on addressing. Most of our projects get thousands of applicants. So one of the questions that's come up is if Laura applies for a unit today and lives in Emeryville, but the unit isn't available for another 5 years, does her preference happen at the point mm-hmm. that the unit is available, or is it from the point that she applied? Mm-hmm. That's a question. What's happening right now is the preference is assigned at the lottery, but when the applicant is called for the unit, they have to prove. And who knows whether or not they still have documentation of where they lived 5 years ago. So that's something that we just need to clear up and address. Like, do you still have to approve it 5 years later? Or should you only have to approve it at the point you get preference? It's not clear. So that's one of the things that we need to clear up in our language.
Okay.
There's a couple of other little small nuances like that as well.
Are there items here that you think would actually, so some of these are, but that seems like it could maybe be, rather than like a large focus, it could be something that could be done within a single meeting, right? We could provide feedback on that.
It's even about staff prioritizing. Like some of these are things that we need to work on. Emily and I just have to have the time dedicated to say, you know what, this was identified as a priority. We need to work on addressing and drafting this policy, getting, you know, the city attorneys to review it, getting Chad to review it. I'm sorry. Have you guys all met Chad?
No.
I'm so sorry.
I'm myself.
Oh, you guys are new. Oh, I'm so sorry. So this is Chad Smalley. He is the director of community development. So he is my manager. He's over economic development and housing, building and planning. And so he's going to talk about food enforcement for you guys in a little bit. But yeah. So, but it would go to Chad, and then we would bring it to you guys to talk about, review, and then once we figure out what that updated policy is, I'd have to go back and look to see if it needs to go back to city council. I think it does, because I think it is built in within our ordinance, that it would be something we'd bring to city council to make that change.
I guess my point is just that Like, are there items here that could really benefit from the discussion of this group and our input? Is there a lot to discuss there that we can really help to weigh in on?
That's a great question. So yes, I think the updating the live work school preference, we could bring to you guys what are some of the issues. We could discuss like ways that you think are best to resolve them related to the live work preference. I think that would be a good one. And something that could happen fairly easily. The tenant protections is also a good one. And then I think the accessory dwelling unit incentive program or the homeowner retention program. Those are two things that we at some point soon need to start working on building out. And so there are a couple of ways we could approach those programs. So I think those are definitely going to be fruitful conversations for us to have as to what you guys think is the best serve the community.
Can I ask, you mentioned Emily said
yes to introduce me.
I just want
to explain who I am as well.
Sorry. Last time, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, sorry. So Emily, she is currently our community development intern.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So she's been with us for a while. She graduated from graduate school and law school last December, July.
Officially the grad school, it's May.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. She comes to our classes, but she couldn't be here at the end of last year, the last semester, because she had classes on Wednesday. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now she's back because the classes are over. So she's back here attending the meetings. And I forgot, yes, you guys joined after she had to go have the evening classes. So
nice.
These aren't like not substantial contributions to the discussion about prioritization, but there are just like some minor things. You might have already caught them in the memorandum, the discussion up above. So we are meeting monthly now as opposed to bi-monthly.
Yes.
And I think some of the dates just need to be updated, but that was the main thing. It's just that was one of our accomplishments of the past year.
Right? Yes. That is true. Yes. So any thoughts on what you guys want your two priorities to be?
Tenant protection, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think we're all in agreement. And I'll identify that as our first priority because I think we will have some good accomplishments on that one this year. And then for the second one, and we can identify some other things that you guys are interested in, but I at least want to specify the specific second priority that you guys want to focus on.
The affordable housing regulatory program has a good umbrella, covers a lot of things. I would like to push that up to the second priority.
I think the way I can work it is we'll talk about the affordable housing program, and you're right. Several of these things can fall under that. The live work preference will fall under that. We can do the barriers for a marketing plan that can fall under that.
The affordable housing for artists fall under that?
No.
No, partially not.
What about the homeowner retention program?
Just said.
Could it be a priority?
It could be out there. They don't have to go, but
it could be the third. I mean, I can identify it as the other things that were of importance to the committee.
Yeah,
I think everything on this list is important.
Yeah, exactly.
I know.
Can we just come up with some rubric?
It's almost like an action item list, right? Like, what are we going to have first? Is that what we're trying to do? Just prioritize what you're like for time management? Are these all going to go?
Yes, I mean, our work is always, there's always this much work and this much time to do it in. So I would characterize this exercise as giving a sort of a second tier in some cases, where, and that is when you depart from the things on the city council's strategic plan, that's the top four of those is the very tippy top. Mm-hmm. And then to the extent committee aligns with things in the strategic plan, those are definitely up there, right? Mm-hmm. And then things you identify that are not in the strategic plan would be the next notch down. And then other things are below that. Now, we usually, stop me if this isn't the case for you, but the, because I do the same exercise for the Economic Development Committee. So the requirement is for us to find these top two priorities, but we usually throw a paragraph in there as well about the other items that you're interested in or that were of particular, you know, interest of the committee to kind of cover you in those spaces too, so that it's not like, well, these aren't the only two things we're gonna do.
Yeah.
There's other stuff we are interested in talk about. And then, and I don't know if you mentioned this in your report, but so part of this is that typically the chair, but it can be whoever you designate, is going to present this to the city council and talk about this, and you'll get some feedback potentially from them on that, so that they know what the committee is interested in as well.
And did we say, I'm sorry if I missed this, but did we already say what, since these aren't the city council's priorities, what are
the protection? That's on their list.
Mm-hmm. Of their like top.
The top four are not housing projects. So they are the revenue measures for the upcoming ballot, the Sutter Health Development Project. Mm-hmm. The 40th Street, project, the multimodal project.
Which one?
40th Street. The transportation thing where bike lanes and whatnot. And then the Art Center project. So those were the top four this particular round.
It's the Art Center project.
The Art Center project ostensibly is, I've been working on it for 9 years. But so is this building behind us here, this brick building, was purchased by the former redevelopment agency to be an art center. And we've been attempting for many years since its purchase, actually, to develop an art center, which would have gallery space, performing space, classroom space, and other programs. And it's been difficult to accomplish, but we've been working on a restart of that project since early last year.
That's interesting.
Very expensive. That's the shortest answer I can give.
Is there much information on that project?
I'm in the city council.
And on March 17th, a study session, but there is a ton of.
I'm just kind of trailing off of it. Maybe not much.
How did they identify their top four?
Yeah, just considering
they voted.
Yeah.
Between themselves.
Yeah.
Between them, they all voted as to what their priorities, and the ones that had the most votes became the top four.
That's very interesting that housing didn't know as the housing even fell in.
It's weird because it's actually the largest category of the entire list of the 40 some items. There's more housing topics on that list than anything else.
So we bring that to that, just like, hey guys, just wanted to highlight this while we bring.
So what I would say is that there is a presentation. So as Chad mentioned, usually the chair or the vice chair will do a presentation before city council, going through the report as to what we identify. That's always an opportunity for additional comments. I've heard other committees make all kinds of comments. So there always could be somewhere where, you know, that could be something that's identified that you guys found it interesting.
Yeah.
That there were so many housing projects on the top, but none that made the top four.
That might be because there's so many that the attention is so diffuse. You know, if you're picking four things and there's 10 of them that are, you know, different council members perhaps feel strongly about one of those things, but not
because they did get votes, they just didn't get as many.
Yeah.
It is surprising though. I mean, especially given the basically the progress that we reviewed last time for the past year, where we really for the past 2 years, we have not really been increasing the affordable housing stock at all. And it's unfortunate, actually, that that isn't one of the top priorities for this coming year, given that we've been falling off.
And I would think, like, if something like that, just because this is the little details that we share, but if that project, the Archive Shows, has been worked on for 9 years, right? If it's something mm-hmm. that has been in development, been in priority for 9 years, you would think maybe we could.
Well, it has not been a priority.
Oh, just no. recently.
So it was not on last year's prior. It was on the 2 years before. On the top priority list, but it didn't make the top four. It became one of the top four last month.
Just this month.
Could you request, like, I don't know, or this is like probably public information somewhere, but where can we get these top four priorities for the?
It's going to be the final report. Is it still in draft form from that session that we did just a few weeks ago? Mm-hmm. It's eventually going to be published as part of the, I think, of the 17th, the March 17th City Council meeting. It'll be published and given to them mm-hmm. on the agenda, mm-hmm. and then it'll be posted to the website. So all of this material. Yeah.
But you can see last year's all that is on the website.
And then, yeah, and the quarter, and we also report quarterly on all of the items. So those reports are all on the website as well.
Were housing items in the top four within the past 2 years?
No. Well, I mean, this process is kind of new.
Only in year two.
Yeah, the way they're doing this now is not the way that it was done in the 2 or 3 years prior. The 2 or 3 years prior, the city council actually didn't have a full session about it. They just had an agenda item at the beginning of the year where they determined what their top 10 priorities were. And it was very ad hoc in a kind of way. I think we did 4300 San Pablo Avenue was on there at some point. And if I remember correctly, it did get a couple. It just didn't make quite to the top four. It did get some top votes from some of the council mm-hmm. members this time. Mm-hmm. So it's still in the mix, right? And it's still something that's of interest to them.
So what's 4300?
That is the intergenerational project on the old recreation center across from Bank of America.
Mm-hmm. And so what are they saying just like about developing it? That's what they're looking at.
About moving that project forward.
Just,
yes.
It's already entitled. They just need to get it forward. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that sounds important.
That's actually
yes. I like that. Maybe that could be another thing. If we're still looking for two, I don't know if
I can put that in the other things. But what I think I heard, and then you guys can tell me if you're ready for a vote, was for first would be tenant protections, mm-hmm. and then second will be our affordable housing program. I'm gonna take the word regulatory out there, mm-hmm. and then I'll bullet out the regulatory changes that we want to make, the changes to the marketing plan about assessing serving underserved populations, the live work regulations.
Yeah.
And then under other items, what I heard was the development of 4300, our homeowner retention and housing for artists. That's other things.
Yeah, because I don't believe it's weird. Anything for homeowners in that.
Yeah,
I think it's important to focus on that too. Absolutely. not just renters.
Retain the homeowners.
Yeah, the homeowner retention program. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Quick question: why is the so if we remove the regulatory from the affordable housing program item, what's the rationale for not including affordable housing for artists under that rubric?
The affordable housing program is actually a program in our planning regulations. So it is an ordinance, and it's called Affordable Housing Program.
Right.
What's identified here is how it's written in the housing element as regulatory.
I see.
But all those other things are part of the program. They're just not necessarily the regulatory planning side of it. So that's the reason why I was just going to take out the word regulatory, but then we'll talk about the regulatory changes to the live work, the assessment of the marketing plans, all of that falls under there. And artist housing is not a part of the ordinance affordable housing program. That's why it's
that's,
separate.
That's
why it's separate.
Yeah. Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, let's vote.
Yeah, let's talk.
Garen Terra said, let's vote. Okay, so did I have it right, though, the way that I did? Emily, you got it? I think
thanks.
I got it.
Okay. We have the San Pablo Development Home and Retention Program Housing for Artists. Otherwise, did you have another one?
It was the ADU instead of, I said.
So, I mean, I what I'm hearing is there were not like there were mainly two options that like that you guys think that we should prioritize, correct?
The request is for two.
Okay. And then out of all these ones that we all named off and went around and named them off, like the two that I'm hearing are going to be most appropriate according to like whatever, according to you guys, is like, are those two or are the rest of them? Because I mean, I'm not sure like how we are determining like what is most important right now.
So I think the tenant protection and then the affordable housing program will identify as the top two priorities, but we'll say in the report that these are the other items that are of interest to the housing committee, okay. And that we hope to work on over the next year.
Okay.
I move that we would. No, right? I move that this committee decided that our first priority will be the tenant protection. Mm-hmm. The second one will be affordable housing. And then we wanted to include other ones that we felt that our committee was in need of, which is the homeowners retention,
mm-hmm.
ADU, and housing for artists.
And 4,300.
And 4,300 for the Pablo.
Got it. And so you're making the motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second. All right. Thank you. All right. I will take roll. All right. So we have Member Drummond.
Yes. Hi.
Member Jessup.
Hi.
Member Johnson.
Hi.
Member Medeiros. And Member Oakley.
Hi.
All right. Item passes.
Member of the public until the reasonable accommodation.
Got it.
All right. And so we can go on to the next item.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Our next item, did Ellen need to go?
No, okay. Not today. Okay. We are going to get to the point where she will. That's okay. In process.
Agenda item 6 is information item 6.1, overview of code enforcement.
And I'm going to turn it over to Chad.
Thank you. That's all I need here. So that's Chad Smalley. I'm the community development director. As Valerie mentioned, I oversee planning, building, and economic development and housing. And I understand that this committee asked for an overview of code enforcement. And that actually is sort of serendipitous because I gave a adjacent or at least similar related presentation to the Budget Governance Committee, which you have the memo for. About a month ago. And so it includes, but it goes a little further than just an overview of code enforcement. But I think it's germane to this committee's purview of housing because it was mostly about legislation that has passed over the past few years that changed how code enforcement is done from the state's perspective in multifamily housing. Code enforcement obviously is much, much broader than housing. Everything from, you know, it includes housing, but it's also things like, you know, we have rules here that you can't sell flavored vapes. There's tobacco ordinances. There's rules about businesses. There's rules about what you can build in the city's right of way, the streets and things like that. Those are all things that are handled by our code enforcement officer as well. So this presentation that I'm going to give you here, I gave to the Budget Governance Committee about a month ago, and I think it will address. It maybe goes a little further than what you asked for in terms of the specific legislation, but it should fill the bill. So let's see if I can make this work. I'm not used to this format. So the reason I took this to Budget and Governance, in May of last year, the City Council asked for a future agenda item about new laws pertaining to multifamily housing. And it took some time to understand what new laws were being referred to, but eventually it was determined through later correspondence with Mayor Carr, who was the person that suggested this, that it was AB 838 that was adopted by the legislature in 2021, AB 548 in 2023, and SB 1465 in 2024. this item, the city council, when they look at a future agenda item, they take sort of raise of hands, and if there's votes that to bring make it a future agenda item for themselves, they can do so if they have a majority vote. In this case, they elected to refer it to the Budget and Governance Committee. And that was what the council asked me to do. So then what this presentation does is it goes through each of those pieces of legislation, what they did, and then what the implications for the city is code enforcement were. And part of this is then explaining how code enforcement works typically in general. So at AB 838, the state law that requires an enforcement response to tenant complaints. What it did is it amended the state's health and safety code that said that if a city or a county receives a complaint of substandard conditions, and those are outlined by those two sections in the health and safety code, which I'll get to in a moment, that the city must inspect the unit and the surrounding premises, that's not defined in this legislation, and that we are to document those violations from a visual inspection. We have to provide notice to the property owner if violations are found, with corrective action of how to fix them, and with copies to the complainants at no charge. The city cannot require that tenants give notice to property owners before they complain. We can't require that they be current on rent in order to inspect the unit. We can't require that they be compliant with their lease terms, and we can't require that they not be in a legal dispute with their landlords. What you'll see from this, now, that's kind of interesting, right, to review, because you'd think, my God, is there a city that's doing such a thing? And I suspect there were. In this city, that's never been the case. We never ask a tenant if they're current on their rent as a precondition of addressing a code enforcement case. So what you'll see in all three of these pieces of legislation is that I think they may have been written with certain other communities in mind that maybe were not great actors as regards rental housing. So on to the next one, AB 548 in 2023 requires that the cities establish a policy regarding inspection of additional units in multifamily buildings. It too amended the health and safety code. And it says that I believe it was by the 1st of January in 24, it was either 24 or 25, that every city adopt a policy for inspection when conditions are observed that may affect other units. It has to identify the criteria for determining the cross-unit risk, and then at a minimum, inspect the immediately adjacent units side by side and above. And the policy also allows for inspection of all the units if severe building-wide conditions are found. There's a certain level of discretion involved in this because it depends on the thing that's found. If it's something that's obviously affecting other units, then we look at other units. If it's obviously a very localized thing, then you're not going to inspect the entire thing. Okay. Then the third piece of legislation was SB 1465. This one expanded the definition of residential unit under the code and expanded code enforcement authority. Some of this bill is a little wonky and very technical, but in summary, it revised the health and safety code to clarify that a substandard building includes buildings where substandard condition exists to the extent it endangers life, limb, health, property, safety, and welfare of the nearby residents, as well as occupants. The nearby residents is the portion that was added. It already had the occupants, but it was expanded slightly. The more substantive expansion, I think, is that it applies regardless of the zoning or the approved use. So if you have somebody, a tenant, who is living in a unit, and that unit wasn't approved to be a unit, it's in a commercial building or something like that, the standard still applies. That wasn't in the law before. And so I can imagine that some cities took the approach that if they found a unit, somebody living in some space that was not approved for residential use or was even just not zoned for it, it was like zoned commercial, that they wouldn't act on the code enforcement complaint. This clarified that it does apply. It incorporated municipal code violations into state enforcement authority and expanded receivership provisions. This is the wonky part. The receivership provisions is when you have a very reticent, you know, you have severe problems in a building, and you cannot get the owner to correct them despite all of the efforts, which I'll go to in a moment. You can, the cities can go to court and ask the judge to appoint a receiver for the property to correct the violations. What this did was made some technical clarifying things that you can do that even if some other action's already happening, because there were some defenses to receivership that were being deployed in other cases. So it's a super added edge case kind of situation that applies.
What is a receiver? Sorry.
That's when, like, you basically lose control of your property. So as a property owner, if I just never did anything and it was a like terrible situation, we did do this once in Emeryville, though I wasn't directly involved in it. It was years ago, where there was a code enforcement case and absentee ownership. We couldn't get anything done. We had a court with a receiver, and the receiver ended up working with, I believe it was Habitat for Humanity, to correct the violations. So in summary, all three taken together, this is the implications for the city. The city has to respond to tenant complaints regarding substandard housing conditions and lead hazards and conduct inspections in response to them. We have to ensure the inspections in extended units that might be reasonably expected to be impacted by substandard conditions found in the unit that the complaint was coming from. We have to provide the documentation on those complaints and inspection reports to property owners and tenants at no cost. Reinspect those units to verify compliance and apply these standards regardless of how the property is zoned or what it's approved for. And so now I'll go into what we do. So I mentioned this health and safety code section when we talk about substandard. It's a defined term. And but this health and safety code section lists a whole host of things that would be considered substandard. The thing is, the state code is not super objective on all of these things. It'll say something like a unit has to have adequate heat. That's it. So what most cities do, including the city of Emeryville, is we adopt, as part of our building code, we adopt the International Property Maintenance Code, or the IPMC. The IPMC covers the same areas that the health and safety code does. But it says, instead of adequate heat, it says you must have heating equipment capable of obtaining or of maintaining 68 degrees at a point measured 3 feet above the floor. Something like, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but that kind of specificity gives an objective standard for us to compare to. And so it effectively implements these sections of the health and safety code. We adopted the most recent IPMC version on November 18th of last year. Every 3 years, this code changes on the same cycle as the building and the fire codes. So, and there's a whole long process for this, but the international code gets, you know, developed. The state adopts its version, the California Building Code, and it makes tweaks to that. And then cities adopt that code, and we can make amendments. Well, we used to be able to make local amendments to these codes. We're precluded from doing that now because of state legislation that aims to streamline development of housing. Mm-hmm. But any amendments that we had prior to that legislation carry forward. Examples of that mostly are administrative, for the most part, like establishing our fees and making it clear what our building permit fees are and things like that. But from time to time, you get more substantive amendments, and those are normally in the building code. I think we were one of the first jurisdictions to require certain fire safety protection equipment and staging of things when multifamily buildings are constructed, because the intersection building on San Pablo Avenue burned down twice. And while it was under construction, you may remember that it was terrible. And we actually changed the code so that those standpipes have to go out. So that's an example where you have to justify changing this code, and we were able to in that case.
Could you tell me again the state's definition of substandard?
The state's definition of substandard is a whole list of things in 179.20.3, health and safety code. Right. I think I attached that to the staff. Yeah. The IPMC is what actually puts specificity to them.
And the IPMC is just like accessible online, just from Google search or something.
Yeah.
It may be. We also we always have a copy here. This is state law that we have a hard copy. This is just funny trivia. Of the building code, we are required to buy it. There is only one company you can buy it from. I wish I could create a situation like that for myself, because it was about $1,300 for that hard copy.
It's not like on the city's website.
Our local amendments are, so the ordinance that we adopted by reference. So we have an ordinance in the Emeryville Municipal Code. It says the city hereby adopts the IPMC. Mm-hmm. And with these local amendments, and then it spells out the local amendments. Mm-hmm. But the IPMC lives in a different document. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think you can access it online, but I'm not sure if it's pretty. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, the multifamily building inspection policy, as I mentioned, AB 548 requires all cities to adopt a policy about inspecting adjacent units. We did that effective January 1st, 2025. That was attached to the staff report, and it addresses all of those items in that legislation. Here's the core of what you requested. What is the overview of it? The code enforcement in Emeryville is a complaint-driven process. What I mean by that is that we do not proactively go out looking for violations. That is very, very common amongst all cities, because resource limitations, and also it's a good way, in my thinking, it's a good way of deriving what is actually a problem. There's a lot of codes in the city that can be violated, and the ones that are problems are the ones that we want to focus our resources on addressing. So we respond to complaints. There's various ways complaints can come into the city. One is through our C-Click-Fix system that's online. You go online and you can pick a location. You can submit a complaint through that. Those get routed based on what the complaint is about to different staff, and oftentimes it's code enforcement.
Where's that located? I actively went to try to find that before.
Actually, if you go to the housing page, I have a link to C-Click-Fix under tenant resources. Okay. So, and I think it says specifically, like, if you have a habitability, click here, and that will take you directly to
C-Click-Fix. That's one way. There's right from the front page, though. I just can't remember the nomenclature. Okay. Report of concern is a tile right on the front page. Mm-hmm. Of the city's website, and it goes into that system. Mm-hmm. The other way to submit a complaint, we do have, you can email us, and there's also a paper form that we have available. It can either be downloaded, or you can just get it at the front desk.
And who does it go to in the email? Whose email?
To Nicole Ewing, to the code enforcement officer, is where it'll end up. Or just direct contact. You can call Nicole. That's also a way of submitting a complaint. So all three of these methods are used.
No, go ahead. Should we ask questions? Should we wait till the end, Chad? Would that be better?
I don't really mind either way.
I do have a question about the complaint-driven piece, because I guess my question might be, I understand that it sounds like it's quite common, is what you're saying, among cities, because it's, you know, it's difficult to be monitoring every issue in every building at all times. You know, we're not in a hyper surveillance state.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
you also don't want this to be punitive, right? In a way.
But I do wonder to what extent the city has considered that this kind of approach does tend to put the burden then on residents, mm-hmm. right? To basically make complaints. And that can sometimes create, depending on what the types of issues are, but the fact that, you know, it's residents themselves that have to make complaints can sometimes create conflict within local communities.
That is true. I've seen that everywhere I have worked.
It's so I do wonder, you know, it's I think that's unfortunate. And, you know, sometimes a resident may be making a complaint that is, you know, it's civic engagement. They're trying to point out, you know, a problem in the community, but they may, you know, see some backlash because of that. And so I do wonder about that. Are there other alternatives, or I don't know, how do you deal with that kind of issue?
No jurisdiction that I've worked in has done anything other than complaint basis. Primarily, I think that it's a resource constraint. I mean, it's not even the case that we can respond to all complaints. I mean, there's more than we can address. So they get triaged in terms of, you know, severity and issues like that. But it's a good point. I think in some ways it maybe is an unavoidable circumstance. I suppose there are limited cases of proactive enforcement, so I shouldn't be so sweeping in that. Like, I know, for example, that some jurisdictions with, you know, that limit short-term rentals, Airbnbs, mm-hmm. will proactively root them out because they'll contract with firms to, you know, find them and address that. But in general, in the main, most communities are running on a complaint basis. In part, too, because some of these things we wouldn't know about otherwise, right? That's the other issue, is that how would we know when somebody complained? Especially for things that are like habitability concerns that are internal to a unit. We don't know whether or not a unit has an issue, has a mold issue or something like that, until somebody, an occupant, says so.
Well, then I guess my question would be, so if this has to be the way it is because of, it's just, you know, this is the resources we have.
In the city, for sure, yeah, you know.
And then I guess the flip side of the question then would be, you know, how does the city then, you know, recognize the issue and perhaps try to protect the complaints from retaliation or from complaints becoming the sort of flagration for a local
conflict? We do allow for anonymous complaints.
Right.
So that's one thing.
Okay.
And then I think in some of our ordinances, you know, at least from the tenant perspective, the tenant protection ordinance does have anti-harassment that a landlord should not be harassing a tenant or, you know, trying to threaten their livability in their unit because a complaint has been made. So we try to put those things in other parts of our, when it comes to tenants and other parts of our laws related to that.
Then the tenant and tenant issues as well.
Right? No, just tenant landlord.
Yeah, a few questions on the Sea Fix Click. Is that new?
No, it's been around for several years.
Okay, and then Nicole, I'm not familiar with that person.
Yeah.
Like if you were going to report something, where is her email located, or how would we know that that's the person that we're emailing or finding? If you wanted to email the form, and say if I sent it to the building,
it still gets her, regardless.
So our code we only have one code enforcement officer, and she currently is Nicole. She is our first code enforcement officer. The city did not have a code enforcement person until maybe 3 years ago. Two or 3 years ago, city had no code enforcement officer. The building department is where code enforcement is housed, and that's where Nicole resides within that division, within our community development department. And so even contacting the building department, it would get routed to her. Yeah. So like if somebody comes up to the front with a complaint, buildings is the one who's at the front, they would then route that information to Nicole.
And the code enforcement page on the city's website has her email and phone number.
Okay, perfect. And then did they have like, what's the line? Like if you don't hear anything back, say you submit a habitability issue and there's no response.
Escalate.
Yeah, what's the next
You go to the building official would be the next in the order. That's who manages Nicole. Jason Williams is the building official. Okay. And then I'm Jason's manager.
And then if you just never hear anything back, what is someone supposed to do?
Should hear something back by then.
Mm-hmm. He pulls pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. I would be surprised.
What I would say also is that, to me, one of the benefits of C-Click-Fix is that it records your complaint, and there's a way for responses there. There's a way to see if an issue has been closed out. Now, I will say, using C-Click-Fix, because I'm new to using it, and so, like, when encampment concerns come in, those get routed to me and to some other people, and I recognize that there are some that are outstanding. Those issues have been resolved. I haven't gone into the system and updated it, so I think there is a mechanism to do that. But then it's also a recorded listing. And so if at any point in time we wanted to see, well, how many habitability concerns came in, we can run a report based off of that system.
The other thing about C-Click-Fix is for stuff like it shows you if the issue has already been reported by somebody else in the public. Right. So oh, the sidewalk's all screwed up at this location. I'm going to put a pin on it. And then you come along. You're like, man, the sidewalk's screwed up. Let me put it. And you go and you locate it. You'll see, oh, somebody's already reported it. And all the city's responded or not. Or I'm going to add my comment to it, right?
So say if you, have a habitability issue and you leave that residence and you have submitted a code enforcement thing and it was never followed up on, is there any, restraints around, even though you're no longer residing there, still having that followed up on?
Let me see if I can break your question into two parts. So I think one of the questions is, when a code enforcement case is lodged,
the complaint,
and let's say it's coming from a tenant on a property.
Yeah.
Nicole does outreach to the owner. Mm-hmm. Does outreach also go back to the person who made the complaint, or does it just go to the owner?
It should go to, if an action was taken, it should go to the tenant as well.
But if it was anonymous.
If it was anonymous, they're not going to be able to get back to it. Right. And that goes back to our original question. So if you want to hear back, right, you have but to put your name.
We're going to know. I mean.
You're going to know who it is.
That's what I wanted to define.
In order to do the inspection, we have to get in the unit.
Say the habitability issue, you need to leave your unit, right? Mm-hmm. So if the code enforcement does not, if they're, action doesn't happen within the time frame and you need to leave, how does that work?
If there was a code enforcement complaint, there was an action that was required to be taken. During that time when the owner has to resolve the issue, the tenant no longer lives in the unit. I think your question is, would the tenant still be contacted even though they don't live in the unit any longer as to the resolution of their code enforcement?
No, thanks.
If we can, yes.
And then if it's still pending for action to happen and you want to follow up on these things because it's impacted you.
Can you?
Yeah, how do you follow up, or can you follow up?
Can follow up, yes.
And I think I saw in there that a case number is created.
Yeah.
And
let me back up that, because that's actually a good segue from where I'm going.
Let me just ask one more thing on this, because with the complaint driven piece, I understand if you want to sort of back to your identity here, you submit an anonymous complaint. That does mean that you forego the ability to hear back on that complaint.
That is the level of specificity that I need to check on and get back to you on, because I'm not sure that that is necessarily the case.
Because if the question I want to ask is, if you do give your name for a complaint, for residents making a complaint, let's say about a property, and they give their name because they want to hear back and they want to be able to follow up, is it against policy to share the name of that complainant and that identity with the property, with the Exactly. The person who's, yeah, on the other side of that.
And that I will need to check with.
Like, all complaints are public information, basically.
Is that true? Like, your name?
Well, that's the question.
Right? Yeah.
You don't have to, right? You have an email address, right? You don't have to say your name or an email address.
That's true. And then, so I guess,
you know, so these specific questions on anonymity and public records are things I'm going to have to follow up.
Okay.
You're calling out because it's all about giving your name, right? I would like to know what was taken care of.
Potentially. And so this is the, I am proceeding here with a, some of these questions are to the level of specificity that I don't have the answer right to hand, but I can get them.
And I did have, before we move along, the C-plate fix is for complaints to Nicole, and how there are landlords kind of like monitored, who oversees them, what person,
in addressing the code violation,
but also foreseeing what could possibly go wrong as far as health and safety.
So the building division would oversee whatever the code violation is. Then Nicole, through the building division, would oversee whatever the remedy is or corrective action is.
Mm-hmm.
And Nicole would do the follow-up. Or it could be one of the building officials who are assisting her in doing that.
It's case-specific, and it depends on the violation. Yeah. So, firstly, C-click fix is for more than just code enforcement. It's for all kinds of stuff. So it's not just that. It's not just Nicole. Just want to make that clear.
Okay.
It depends on the violation. If, for example, if a complaint comes in about an issue that this is actually perfect jumping off spot for me to go to the next step. So the complaint comes in, Nicole then investigates, essentially. She goes out to see what the issue is, if it's there or not, if it's evidence enough to say that, yes, there is a violation. If there is a violation that she's observed, then our first preference is always to get just voluntary resolution without going down the full board enforcement process. Because a lot of times you get complaints about something and the landlord or the violator has no idea. Like they just didn't know that was the requirement or the law. And all it takes is a phone call from Nicole saying, hey, did you know that's illegal? And oh, I didn't. I'm sorry. And they fix it. And that the whole aim of this process is not to collect fines or to be punitive in any way. It's to get compliance. And the fastest pathway to compliance sometimes is simply letting the violator know that they have a violation. If they do not, if we don't get that, or if it's like more egregious than that, like we can't contact them. Like if it's hard to get to the property owner, sometimes that happens. And we can only get them through mail. If we don't know how to get a hold of them, then the next step is a notice of violation. This is a process spelled out in the municipal code. Notice of violation is required by the code to include a description of what the violation is and how to correct it, and a reasonable time frame within which to correct that violation. Then, again, it's sort of with the aim of compliance, we hope to see motion towards that end, towards correcting the violation. And if they are doing that, they can request extensions on their timeline to comply. And we typically will grant them if they are actually making a good faith effort to fix the violation. If we do not get that kind of compliance and we're not getting anywhere and the condition is allowed to remain or becomes worse, the next step is an administrative citation, which can include fines. It has to contain the same information that the notice of violation has in it. And the fines are established for violations of the building code, which again includes the IPMC, or the I shouldn't articulate it that way, the building regulations, that chapter of the building code includes the IPMC, or for violations of the planning code, the planning regulations, chapter 9, the municipal code. These are the fines that are established in our master fee schedule. The first violation is $102. Second violation is $205. They escalate. You know, there's a timeline to comply. They don't comply. Now you get the second violation, 205, and so on and so forth. And this is meant to incentivize them to do something because the fines are going to keep increasing.
That's
per violation.
Trying to find the word. Because I know that you're saying a planning code violation, a building code violation. What other kinds of violations?
Other violations, like there's a chapter in the municipal code about maintenance of sidewalks. That's not in the building code. Regulations or planning regulations.
Is there a list of the planning code and building code violations?
No, it's just if you violated that section of the municipal code, that's a violation.
And $102?
That was derived
from the landlord, and I've got a $5,000 repair, then why would I? It didn't matter how many violations you send me, it's going to be less than
able to. Beyond this, we can take any action now, and we can also sue the landlord. At that point. Now, when we get to that point, it has to be egregious because that is a very expensive process for the city to undertake as well. But those amounts were derived from a survey of other cities in the area. So they're in line with our other jurisdictions around here.
Well, there's no real incentive for them to fix the problem, right?
Well, there is. I mean, in the sense that if they don't resolve it, these fines continue to compound and compound and compound and compound, right? And because that last amount, the 500, that third and every one after, I mean, it's going to go up $500 at a time each time you miss the, you know, so you can imagine how in a situation where you've got like
$2,000
four codes you're violating, it's going to be $2,000 every, you know, 2 weeks you don't respond to this thing. Okay. And it's going to, and they do start to ramp up pretty quick if they don't respond.
Okay.
Yeah.
So after the, let's say, a notice of violation and, the issue, the violation is, let's say, fixed.
Corrected. Okay, yep.
Corrected. First of all, is there a second inspection? Are there, how do you monitor?
After the notice of violation, you know, the corrective actions outlined, the timeline to complete it is, and then the re-inspection is the typical way of verifying compliance. And if it's all good.
The issues are one type of issue, but, you know, there are all sorts of code violations, and some of them are, you know, some that, unlike, you know, habitability, where you kind of fix it, it's going to take a long time for that to develop again. If I don't know, like blocking the public right of way or what have you, it's something that, I'll just unblock the public right of way for the reinspection, but then I will block it right away again after.
Yeah, yeah, we'd come back in.
So that's not starting over from zero.
Right. No. Well, it depends. That's a case dependent thing, but it kind of depends on like how much time we're talking about, what it is.
Right.
But no, if we had a recurring thing that was kept going on, we could move into administrative citation at that point.
Okay.
Because it's continuing. We can also very quickly, the timelines are all dependent on what it is too, like what to correct it. So if it's something simple, then it's like, okay, hey. But if it's, and that's what those fines, the description in the municipal code is that it is also for like recurring things. Right. Like the second violation of the same thing is going to be 205 if we get to this point.
Right, just escalation. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And sense. Is Nicole the same person that evaluate? Like, who's evaluating?
That depends on the topic. So if like whether a violation exists
Well, yes, but also like the good faith resolution, or like the good faith act that they're going to do something and what that looks like and what the plan is. Who's
Nicole primarily, but it depends on, it does depend on the specific violation, because if you found a whole host of structural issues in a building, for example, that is going to be, the corrective action there is going to be to come into the building department and get division and get permits to fix it. And understanding whether actual progress is being made on that, she's going to need to consult with the building division to know whether, like, is this applicant, did they come in? Did they get them? Did they respond to the comments on their drawings? Did they actually do it timely? You know, is it, you know, or is it stalled? Do we need to move to an administrative citation now because they just seem to have like stopped doing the work? So that is collaborative depending on what it is. Example being like with sidewalk stuff, she's working public works on those because that's their realm. Buildings is building, you know, that's, but she is the primary person that's making the determination of whether that person is responding and actually making progress.
And do you guys have like an internal timeline for each of these things, or like window of time that's allowable?
It's all dependent on the circumstance. There's such a wide variety of issues that we don't have a standard.
Is that something you guys would develop?
No, because I don't think I could ever imagine a standard that would cover every permutation of violations that could exist.
And so along those lines, like the scope of what Nicole has to cover. So Nicole is working, it's a building specific, is that right?
Or
is
what
that
I'm talking about now is, but she's got other issues too.
The whole code.
Yes.
Everything.
Yes.
Crazy. It's yes. Crazy. It's intense.
Yes.
And so what is the, how is this process documented? So we have a complaint come in, we have a field inspection, we have a re-inspection, we have a notice, administrative citation, et cetera. There may be reliance on further, you know, complaints later to figure out, like, so is that all documented?
Like, yes. So once we get past this voluntary piece where, like, it doesn't get corrected and we're issuing a notice of violation,
yeah,
a case file is created.
Okay.
Our permitting software includes code enforcement cases, and there's a module of our software that tracks that. So the case, if it gets to this point, the case number is generated, and there's a file in there that shows like when it was open, what the issues were. The documents then are attached to that, and then when it's closed, that's noted the time and why it's noted in there as well. That's all going to change in the next, you know, 6 months or so, because we're changing our permitting system over to a new software vendor. And it should be better than, because I'll tell you, the one we have right now is not very good in that it's hard to use. It may, and that up to your point, Julia, there are capabilities in this software where it might create, I'm not sure about this yet because we're still in the implementation stage, but it may create another avenue for which complaints could be generated and monitored by the public. To be determined, obviously, but potentially. I know it does do that for building permits. It allows people to apply online. Today, we don't have a way of doing that. Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful that it does have that capability or that we're able to utilize it.
But there is a list of permits.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, there's permit files for every building permit that's ever pulled.
But the permitting software tracks complaints of all types of code violations.
Yeah. Right? If she generates a case file, it's in there.
Okay.
Can't remember how many we're up to this year. Probably close to 100.
Yeah, that's a good question too. I am curious, like, so within this massive scope of, you know, violation, code violations, code enforcement, like what is the kind of, and you know, I'm sure you don't have the numbers in front of you, but like, what is the sort of general distribution? Like, what are the types of violations that are the most common that like Nicole has to go out and deal with? And what are sort of the outliers? You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
Please.
It's just also like with that information, you know how we were talking about, like, well, you can't go out and just find all these code violations.
Yes.
Like, with that information, would that help kind of put a point to where one might want to look if there was a recurring?
Yes, potentially it can identify issues that way.
Yeah.
We'll say it's hard to keep up just with the complaint driven basis. And so, you know, to the extent the public complains, you know, if something gets bad enough that the public complains about it, we have trouble even meeting that standard.
Mm-hmm.
So adding proactive enforcement to that would be a challenging thing to do. But maybe it heads off. I think what you're getting at, it heads off a number of those. Mm-hmm. I don't have the breakdown right now. And I also know that it's also in a city the size can be skewed.
Mm.
I know for a fact last year, she spent a good amount of time following up on complaints about things that were built in the city right away, because a single person complained about every instance of things found in the city right away.
Oh, wow.
So
excuse the number.
Right. Every city has people's
and those get triaged. Like I said, they get triaged like anything else.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you know, we know, like, you know, if somebody builds a free little library in this and it happens to be in the right of way, it's probably not a health and safety risk. And so it's going to be deprioritized. But that you'll see that in a city this size, it's easy to move the numbers with things like that. That said, This slide here talks about what the consequence of the legislation and how the city complies to it. So respond to tenant complaints. I mentioned we're complaint based and those complaints result in inspections. Inspections extended units. We've adopted that policy that I mentioned and attached. Provide the documentation. Yes, we do that. And it's also included in that policy. Reinspect them. That's our standard practice through the NMV, which says, how do I fix this? Well, you can call us and tell us that you fixed it after we told you how to do it, and we go back and make sure you did so. And then apply those standards regardless of zoning or approved use. But the legislation changed that, but we never distinguished here. So that was already our practice.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just sort of affirmed by state law, which helps us. So with that you give me a couple of questions to follow up on, which I think the way I'll do that is to work with Nicole and get a memo
specifically to you.
Yeah. But any other questions on code enforcement? Take this down.
I'm curious the relationship between code enforcement and then the tenant protection policy modifications.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why, you know, obviously it's so important to everyone, including council.
Yeah.
Like, well,
yes.
Can you like speak to that maybe a little bit?
You want to touch that? Because we are going to talk
about one of the things that we're going to be doing in the tenant protection ordinance is defining substandard condition. Because that previously was not defined in our ordinance. So we are going to be adding some more specific information to make things a little bit more clear, not only for the tenants, but also for the landlords, and so that it's all being interpreted the same way.
So the substandard section that was saying substandard, when I asked what is the substandard, the tenant ordinance is going to be different from that definition, or is it going to adopt the same definition?
It'll most likely adopt that definition. I mean, the definition of substandard talks about like lack of roof or lack of flooring, lack of water. Those are the things that are in the state code.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how we do it. But that's kind of how we've always related to our definition of substandard. We've seen some other jurisdictions put a little bit more specificity in regards to resolution or how long it'll take to resolve an issue. So those are the kind of things that we're looking at and trying to add to our ordinance. I don't have language, but it will come back to this committee before it ever goes to city council for us to talk about as to how we're looking to define substandard and then what would be in our ordinance moving forward.
What is the definition in the ordinance now?
There is no definition. It's part of the problem.
Yeah.
If there is none, then the state does not supersede it.
It defaults to the state.
IPMC to help.
No, my understanding is that we just default to what the state defines as, you know, like the lack of water, the lack of heating, the lack of roof, no egress. Those are the things that we're defining as substandard right now.
I just want to say thank you so much for this presentation. Like it's such an incredibly important part of the city's work, I think, and it's I just really want to express appreciation for the fact that the city has focused on this. This is something new, right? As you put in the documentation, an effort to centralize, streamline, be responsive, document things and track them in the best way possible. I just want to say that those efforts are, and based on, as a resident, my personal experience with all of this is, I just want to say that just to express gratitude to the city for this, program, so I think it's an excellent addition.
I will pass that recognition on to Nicole and note that, like, yes, to your point, the code enforcement was severely under-resourced in the city up until, well, it still is, but not nearly as bad as it was before Nicole. It was the passage of Measure F that allowed that to be the sales tax that allowed us to, you know, the resources to actually do that. Prior to Nicole being here, everything was completely ad hoc. So it depended, I mentioned, like, it depended where the complaint comes from. And it was totally up to that department to try to navigate the notice of violation, administrative citation, how it applied, how it intersected. Like, another example of codes that she helps on is our labor standards. So minimum wage, paid sick leave, fair work week, the hotel cleaning ordinance. Like, these are things. Now, Nicole is not an expert in everything, obviously, but the way we generally approach this is the subject matter expert needs to basically engage Nicole, but, like, have built the case, so to speak. So, like, if a labor standard, if a minimum wage case comes in, and I have staff separate from Nicole that investigate that, they will put that document together and say, look, we have a violation here. And it's then worked with Nicole to go through these same exact steps that apply to substandard housing. There's same steps apply to if someone's not paying minimum wage. There's administrative citations, notice of violation, all that same stuff. I also should mention that at each of these stages, there is a requirement for due process. So, like, an administrative citation is something that can be appealed. And this is all spelled out in the municipal code, but if we issue an administrative citation and the person says, I didn't do that, or even if they did, but they just want to appeal it, they can file an appeal and it goes to a hearing officer that gets appointed by the city, a hearing officer, in this whole, like, process of evidence and determination, you know, is gone through. And then after that, they still have, you know, rights to sue the city if they, you know, if they didn't like the outcome of the hearing.
I see.
So there is a measure of weighing the city's case in these. We have to be pretty confident that it met the, you know, the standard of a violation. We're going to get to that point. We have to be pretty confident that it actually is a violation for us to prosecute to that point.
An administrative.
Administrative citations are really the big trigger on that, because it can kick off an expensive appeal process. We have to be pretty sure that there's a problem to do that.
I see. And does that, so that happens pretty rarely, I assume.
It does happen rarely. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, there's always edge cases and extreme, you know, and I mean, I mentioned the receivership.
Yes. One,
right. That was an extreme case. Then another extreme case was a house that we actually demolished as a result of severe structural issues that were caused by the landowner. It was an unfortunate situation, but just couldn't be resolved otherwise, and it was in danger of falling on the neighbor's house.
Okay.
So there are, you know, those are extreme cases, and those require court orders and things like that. But yeah, I appreciate your recognition of the fact that the city is a way different spot than it was, you know, 3-4 years ago. So
this threshold though, to go from the notice, it seems like it's pretty automatic though, if the conditions are not met in the timeline.
Yes. I mean, again, I'm talking in general. So yeah, there's such a wide variety of varieties. Hey, your weeds are too long. Well, I mean, you know, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we are dealing with.
And in some cities, you get a lot of overgrowth as code violations.
Well, Nicole's prior work was with
trees getting cut down. There's all kind of things.
It's the $50 fines, right? Like,
I mean, that partly, but you know, that's and Nicole and I worked together in the city of Richmond. A long time ago, and I was actually a hearing officer for her cases that got appealed. So for some of them, so I had some exposure to her work before. It's just by circumstance that she came here, but she's been in environments that had much more egregious code cases than the city of Emeryville has had to deal with during the foreclosure crisis. We had blocks of homes that were boarded up or broke into and overgrown and bank owned. And we routinely were dealing with appeals from those banks. But yeah, I would pass it on your kind words. Great. I haven't been to the housing committee in a long time, so it's fun to know.
They're always lively.
Yeah.
They have great questions.
Thank you, Chad.
You're very welcome.
Moving right on to agenda. Number 7. Use your agenda items, projected meeting day 7.1.
Yes. So just as an update, so we do have our affordable housing expenditure and annual report. That'll be coming to you guys April 1st. And then you guys had also wished to add affordable housing for artists. I don't have a meeting date scheduled for that because there's some preliminary work I need to do related to that. So I'm not, probably won't come in April. Hopefully it'll come before June, but that'll be down the line. So that's upcoming. And if anything else pops up, there might be something else on the agenda in April, and I'll know more about that later in the month.
You have a lot of work to do before that March 17th, right?
I do. Emily and I have a lot.
Right.
I share all my purchases.
Any announcements? Member comments?
Oh, I will just give a quick announcement. So I know at the last meeting we did nominate Brooks as our first runner-up for the subcommittee for the visual art grants, and Julia was our backup. There were recommendations that came in from a variety of the committees for that fifth seat. They ended up doing a lottery, and I believe the person from the BPAC was selected through the lottery to be on the visual grant. So I just did want to provide that update to you guys as well.
Have any comments or anything? Well, Chad, we want to thank you again. Our meeting of the Emeryville Housing Committee on March 4th, 2026 is adjourned at
7:33 p.m. Thank you. And I want to say we have not ended before 8 o'clock. It was really long.
It's been a long time. It's
that I only had two agenda items. We're getting caught. We're definitely getting caught. So thank you. Thank you for showing it for us.
So I think if you end.